You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, Pluto gets its close-up, the LHC gets a pentaquark particle, and we all get a new holiday destination with the discovery of the most Earth-like planet yet, Kepler-452b.
Our best picture of Pluto just a couple of weeks ago was just a few pixels really on a screen. It looked totally unremarkable. And now suddenly it looks like a world.
Father of the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, Frank Drake, tells us about a new $100 million mission to listen for alien communications.
Acquisition of knowledge of another civilization. The benefits of such a discovery are just almost beyond belief.
Conjuring a neutron star from a nanowire. New tests aim to bring quantum mechanics and general relativity together in the lab.
And so I can't go to a neutron star to do experiments, but I can do this nanomechanical structure in a laboratory and simulate the gravitational fields on a neutron star.
And how do you explain the workings of the universe using only the most common 1,000 words in the English language?
The story of the book follows a student woman as she goes out one night to seek the help of Big Sear, one of the largest telescopes on Earth, to unlock the mysteries of dark matter.
She's Zia Morali.
And he's Brendan Foster. Welcome to the latest podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. We have a lot coming up in this edition, as you can tell from the opening menu. Oh my, there's been a lot happening in physics news in July, and we thought we should quickly whip through it.
The most exciting of which is that FQXI has announced its newest round of grantees to research the physics of what happens. Details are available on the website fqxi.org.
Seriously, Brendan? You're going to go with that as the most exciting thing of July over, for instance, us receiving the first close-up images of Pluto following a 9-year journey to the dwarf planet, or the creation of a whole new particle, the pentaquark at the LHC, or even the discovery of Kepler-452b, also dubbed Earth 2.0 because it's so similar to our homeworld.
Okay, I'll admit, those were impressive. So yes, first of all, congratulations to NASA's New Horizons team. Their spacecraft flew within just 12,500 kilometers of Pluto and beamed back that now iconic image of the planet with a heart.
Astronomers and astrophysicists, just like the rest of us, have been getting excited about the images and the data as it's been coming in. The day after the spacecraft made its closest approach, I attended an astrophysics meeting organised by University College London at the Royal Astronomical Society. There I managed to grab a couple of minutes to chat with cosmologist Andrew Ponson from UCL, who described the excitement of the flyby to me.
What's remarkable is that this is the last kind of unexplored world in our solar system. And, you know, just over the last few days, it's turned from something which is just a few pixels. You know, our best picture of Pluto just a couple of weeks ago was just a few pixels, really, on a screen. It looked totally unremarkable. And now suddenly it looks like a world. You know, it's almost like discovering it all over again.
So we have seen, you know, this wonderful image that came out with Pluto with a heart on it, and just everybody's getting really, really excited. And it's quite breathtaking and really quite inspiring. But what sort of things can astronomers learn from these kinds of things? I mean, it's a flyby. They haven't sent a lander down. And, you know, one of the questions from one of our listeners was actually, you know, why aren't they sending something down there? But, you know, what sort of information can we still get from this? Because I understand that they're waiting for data to come in.
Yeah, well, the reason you can't send something down onto the surface is just because you're zipping past so fast. So it's an incredible achievement to even get there. But to stop when you arrive would be even harder. So it really is a very rapid fly past. And as they as they go past, they're trying to get as much information as they can. So that involves not just taking pictures, but there are a range of probes that will gather lots of different physical information, which I think, you know, this data, it's going to take a long time to be sent back. And people are probably going to be poring over it and trying to understand exactly what it tells us for at least a decade.
Some of that data that Ponson's mentioned has already started coming back and has revealed some surprises, including mountains of water ice that are more than 3,500 metres high. There's some really nice roundups of what we've learned so far in Nature by Alex Witzer, and I'm linking to those on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. According to Witzer, NASA scientists know that the mountains on Pluto must be made from water ice because only water ice could buttress such huge ridges at temperatures just 50 degrees above absolute zero. The planet also has far fewer craters than scientists might have expected, which could mean that its surface is relatively young, possibly just 100 million years old.
There's also a surprising amount of geological activity on the planet, which suggests that there's an ocean buried under the surface. The ocean could be kept warm by radioactive elements in Pluto's core, but we'll need more data to find out. Also, that bright heart on the surface that's capturing everyone's imagination has a concentration of carbon monoxide ice. And nitrogen glaciers appear to be flowing around mountains and ponding in craters.
At the time of recording this podcast, only about 5% of the data gathered during New Horizons flyby has been received, so there'll be plenty more to come in future months. But based on the reaction to the first images, I had one important question left for Ponson. Okay, so one last question that I have to ask you, because, you know, this has been on Twitter, this has been in the media, you know, there's this question, should Pluto be called a planet again?
I have to say, I have to go with my heart on this. I think yes. I mean, it looks like a planet, doesn't it? I know all my colleagues in planetary science is probably going to kill me for saying that, but you just have to say yes.
So Andrew Ponson wants Pluto to have its full planetary status back. I have to say, I don't mind either way, but I know a lot of people would be happy with that, since they still can't figure out what their very educated mother just served them nine of. How about you, Zia?
Well, you know, I what's wrong with being called a dwarf planet? That's what I say. But then I'm quite short, so maybe I'm biased.
Well said.
Thank you. But the Pluto flyby wasn't the only big physics news on the 14th of July. Particle physicists at the LHCb experiment at CERN announced the discovery of an elusive new particle, the pentaquark. The discovery was made by accident, as the physicists were not even searching for it, according to a new story New Scientist by Gilead Amott, also linked to on the podcast page.
Quarks are elementary particles that are the building blocks of matter. The neutron and the proton each contain three quarks. Particles made up of two quarks are also familiar to physicists.
You may remember physicist and FQXI member Ian Durham talking about the history of the reported detections of the tetraquark, a particle made up of four quarks, on our end-of-year news roundup last year too, which we've linked to on the podcast page. Since the 1960s, physicists have also predicted that a pentaquark with, you've guessed it, five quarks could also exist, and that's what's been spotted at the LHC.
Or has it? The team infer that a pentaquark was produced as an intermediary particle when another particle, called the lambda b, decayed in a number of steps. But there's still some question over whether it should be rightly be considered as a particle of five quarks or a mini molecule made up of a particle with two quarks added to a particle with three quarks. Particle?
Mini molecule?
Planet?
Dwarf planet.
Tomato.
Tomato.
Potato.
Potato.
Oh, let's call the whole thing off.
But oh, if we call the whole thing off, then we won't be able to discuss the next big news item of July, as NASA announced a new haul of planets orbiting other star systems, as spotted by the Kepler telescope, including Kepler-452b, the most Earth-like planet we have yet discovered.
That's right. Kepler-452b lies 1,400 light-years from Earth in the constellation of Cygnus in our galaxy. Due to its size and age, it could be a rocky planet with a thick atmosphere and active volcanoes, although that's speculation based on modeling rather than known facts. Writing for Space.com and Scientific American, Mike Wall notes that Earth's twin is 60% wider and about 5 times more massive, so it's likely that gravity on its surface will be twice as strong as here on Earth. And it orbits its star at a similar distance to Earth's orbit around the Sun. A year on Kepler-452b lasts 385 days, which I think means that you get 20 days extra holiday time there.
Oh, I wish. That also means that it lies the right distance from its star, which is 1.5 billion years older than our Sun, to allow liquid water to exist on the surface. And in turn, that means it could host life.
So, how do we find out if there are aliens there, or indeed anywhere out there?
That's exactly what I asked Frank Drake, one of the pioneers of modern SETI, which stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. Drake was speaking to me in the run-up to the launch of a new $100 million project called Breakthrough Listen to scan the skies for alien communications. The 10-year project is funded by Russian billionaire and trained physicist Yuri Milner and also involves FQXI advisor Martin Rees of Cambridge University. It will use 2 radio telescopes at Green Bank in West Virginia and the Parkes Observatory in Australia and an optical telescope at the Lick Observatory in California to survey the nearest 1,000,000 stars in the Milky Way and also nearby galaxies. Drake, Milner, Rees, Stephen Hawking, and a host of other famous names have also just signed an open letter calling for renewed interest in SETI. Drake carried out the first SETI experiment in 1960 at the Green Bank Telescope, and a year later, at the first ever SETI conference, he came up with an equation to calculate the likelihood that alien civilizations exist. The Drake equation includes many unknown parameters, such as the kinds of numbers that the Kepler mission is homing in on about planets able to host life. We discussed the potential impact of Breakthrough Listen and its search strategy. But first, I asked Drake what drove him to continue with the search for extraterrestrial intelligence for more than 50 years, given how poorly funded it has been in the past and its failure to have found any signals so far.
Well, that's a good question, and it's often asked, and not just in the context of low money, but the fact that we've already searched for 50 years without finding anything. And they say, oh, haven't you really shown there's nothing there to be found? And the answer to that question is we've hardly begun, because we have so many stars and so many frequency channels that are untouched. But anyway, the answer to both of those versions of the question, you know, why do you keep doing this, is that we, once you think about SETI and the impact of a discovery, you are very strongly hit with the thought that the results of the discovery will be momentous. Acquisition of knowledge of another civilization, knowledge of what they are like, what they have accomplished. You realize they will likely be much older than we are, more experienced, with more knowledge and technology from which we could learn, and that the benefits of such a discovery are just almost beyond belief. And so this is what keeps people motivated, even though on any given day the chances of them actually making the discovery are very, very small.
How did you become interested in the first place?
Oh, I got interested when I was about 8 years old. And my father told me one day there were other worlds in space. And to an 8-year-old kid, that meant other Earths, with places just like where I lived and people like me and houses like where I lived and all of that. And that really got my interest and have been interested ever since. And I keep coming back to that thought. What are these other places like? And, of course, the more we know, the more I realize that it's going to be a lot more than just a place like Earth. It's going to be something very different and probably far more advanced.
You know, given that it's a more advanced civilization, they could have more advanced technology, things that we can't even imagine. You know, tell me a little bit about the history of how you kind of all sat down and thought, well, what's the best way to approach this? Because this obviously goes back many decades of. What strategy do you employ?
It goes back 50 years, and there's always this question of a strategy. In our thinking, we have normally been very conservative. We realize there's probably technologies out there beyond our wildest dreams, but we don't know what they are. And so we try to design our searches to detect forms of technology which we know exist, which means our own, because that's the only ones we know exist. So we think about using spacecraft and radio waves and light waves and gravity waves and neutrino beams and all sorts of things. When you do that, you recognize very quickly that the use of spacecraft to go to other worlds is very challenging and very expensive. You always end up thinking that the best way is to capture their radio signals or perhaps light transmissions if they use that to transmit information. But even with the radio, possible frequencies and wavelengths are quite extensive. And so we usually try to use some logic to pick frequency bands which are more likely to be used by the extraterrestrials. And here the universe has given us some help, because there are sources of static radio noise in the universe which are present on all frequencies. And they become quite strong at some frequencies and are really very difficult to use as a communication channel. But in between, there's what we call a window. And we think all civilizations know this, and they will exploit this range of frequencies. Or we call this the water hole, by the way, because the primary spectral lines of H and OH are in this frequency band. We think that's kind of nice because we are water-based life. So there's a whole bunch of poetic sort of coincidence here. Now, as to where to search at the present time, we have so little information on stars with planets that just about every star is fair game. What we've learned is about one in every five stars has a planet in the habitable zone. So basically, we just need to point where the stars are and listen in the water hole, and then search the whole spectral range and the whole sky. And that's a big, big order.
It's big, yes, exactly. Given the funding that URI is giving and this kind of 10-year time frame, and then also given how big the universe is, do you think we'll see something within 10 years?
Yeah, well, that's a question that almost always gets asked, and I dread it. There's no good answer to it, because there's several difficulties with searching the whole sky. One is, what does the bandwidth of the signal? Are we looking for television signals? Are we looking for telemetry like that from a spacecraft? There's also another question, which is, do they transmit in your direction all the time? If you put your place in another civilization which is trying to communicate with people like us, and we hope that's the case, we'd like for them to be helping us, which raises a whole other interesting question, which is there altruism in the universe? But if that's the case, they're presented with a challenge because they don't know where the civilizations are, and so they don't know exactly which stars to transmit to. So how do you cope with this? Well, you probably scan around the sky. You send the signal into one star after another over and over.
Yeah.
And now that creates the problem that we may look at the right star on the right frequency, but at the wrong time.
Yeah.
And so it's just not possible to predict how long it will take, because we don't know how the extraterrestrials are playing the game.
Can I ask you? You mentioned this, this question about whether the other civilizations, whether there's altruism out there, and of course, people also wonder whether alien civilizations might have bad intentions towards us. But what's your personal view on that?
Now, I have a strong personal view on that, and I think that there's no threat to us for two reasons. One is actually send vehicles or anything from one star to another is extremely energy consuming. If we make the most optimistic guesses we can make about where, how close are the nearest civilizations, they're probably at least 100 light years away. The cost also, if you take very simple physics and calculate the amount of energy required to send a spacecraft that might, say, carry 30 people, like it's like a small airliner at a tenth the speed of light. It takes, just to get it up to that speed, about as much power as produced by all the electrical plants of Earth in 100 years.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous, it's just a totally ridiculous amount. So, in a way, the laws of physics and the great distance between the stars are protecting us from attack. If you want to benefit from what the other civilization has, you learn from them how to build things. You don't transport things.
I have to ask you about the Drake equation and how you came up with it, and did you anticipate, you know, how important it would become and how identified it would become with SETI?
Well, I wish there were a story like the story of Sir Isaac Newton and the apple. But there's no such story that goes with that. After I did the first search in 1960, the National Academy of Sciences in the States wanted to have a small conference on this whole subject because it did get a lot of publicity at the time. And they asked me to organize it. So I organized it, and I invited everybody in the world that I knew of that was interested in the subject, all 12 of them. And I realized, well, we've got to have an agenda. You can't just get everybody in a room and start talking. So I sat down and I thought, well, what do we need to talk about? I thought, what matters? And what matters are the seven factors that are in the equation. So I wrote them all down, and I thought, well, that's, each one will be the topic for a session. You know, one rate of star formation will be the morning session, and fraction of stars with planets will be the afternoon session. So that was how I arranged the agenda. And as I was doing it, I realized if you multiplied all these things together, you got the number of technical civilizations in the universe. And that's how it came about. And the interesting thing is it hasn't changed in 50 years.
You know, there has been a lot of progress, and actually very recent progress, in coming up with some of these parameters that you outlined. I mean, you know, and just sort of the search for planets and looking for habitable planets and that sort of thing. Did you anticipate that we would be able to actually get some estimate on the numbers within this time frame?
Well, I knew that some of them are not knowable till we found another civilization. But some of them I knew we were on our way to finding out about, like the typical number of planets in a habitable zone, the number of planets in a planetary system. I thought the chemists would do a much better, more complete job of understanding the chemical origins of life. But there were some things I thought were going to be remain unknown until we've actually detected another civilization. And the one of those which matters the most is the very last factor, which is the length of time a civilization remains detectable. I don't think we can use our own history as a reliable guide.
Why not? Just because we could live a lot longer than we can imagine, or because...
It depends on whether we're altruistic, among other things. Do we send messages intentionally? And also, just what inventions we come up with that make ourselves visible. The Earth is not yet going quiet, but it's on the verge of going quiet, because the main sign of our existence, which is our over-the-air television transmissions, are in a situation where they may be closed out in the near future. On the other hand, there are things that could make us more detectable if we put solar power stations in space, transmitting power to Earth. If we colonize space and have data links between our colonies, that would make us visible. So it's really a very open question, I think, as to how long typically a civilization remains detectable.
What are you looking forward to most now, I guess? What are the sort of the next steps?
There is already a loosely defined plan which calls for us to do a targeted search of stars where we know there are planets in the habitable zone as a result of the radial velocity studies in the Kepler project. So then search the entire Milky Way. That's going to take a lot of time. And then a third project, which is a very speculative one, is to search nearby galaxies for signals. Now, the reason you might do that, you might think, oh, that's crazy, that's very far away, and it is. The signals from another galaxy will typically be a million times fainter than signals from nearby stars in our own galaxy. So for this to succeed, it requires there to be sort of a super civilization in another galaxy. But the good side is that you can search a whole galaxy in almost no time. You can look at 100 billion stars in one night.
Oh, wow. You're talking now about, you know, having so much telescope time and so much potential data coming in. Are you prepared just for the data processing and just for, you know, having to go through this vast amount of data that's going to come in?
No, we have pretty good data processing computer algorithms and programs that have been developed over the years for the searches which are going on right now. But they're not as comprehensive as we'd like. They don't search for every possible kind of signal. Both my worries but also hopes is that perhaps the extraterrestrials are sending us holograms. Holograms, if we could recognize it as such, we know how to decode them. We don't need to know a language or anything. You just record the hologram in the right way and show a laser on it, and there'll be a 3D image of the extraterrestrial standing there looking at you. But a hologram, if you've ever seen one, which very few people have, it looks like noise.
Yes, no, I've made a hologram, and so I do. Yeah, I know what you're talking about. So I had one displayed, I think, in my room, and people used to come and look at it and say, "What is that? It's horrible." You know?
Yeah, that's right. Okay, then you're one of the few people who will understand what I just was talking about. I look at the screen. Could this be a hologram? What we need most right now are computer programmers to deal with the signal types, as I was just talking about. But also we need people just to be at the telescopes, so that if you get a candidate signal, you can immediately take action to identify it and determine whether it's really extraterrestrial or more likely radio interference.
Right, I see, because I guess if you find that out afterwards at a later time, you can't then go back and, or you can try to train your telescope in the same place, but it might have stopped or...
That's right, and that's what's happened at least 100 times. They've gotten very good candidate signals. Haven't discovered it in the data till a month later, typically. They go back, point the telescope, same frequency, and there's nothing there.
Right. I know that, you know, you've got this open letter and that a lot of people have been showing support from all kinds of areas in science. Was that particularly gratifying to you to see that people are really coming together behind this?
Oh, it's very good. And what Yuri's doing is just unbelievable. When I did the first search in 1960, our total budget for the project was $2,000 US. Now we got 100 million. That's real progress. And that's something I never would have believed possible. Not then, and even yesterday almost.
Thank you to Frank Drake for chatting with Zia. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, there's a link to Zia's story about Breakthrough Listen for Nature, plus a link to our podcast interview from 2013 with alien hunter Sarah Seeger. And there's an extended version of that interview with Drake, too.
And I should add that if you're interested in getting a job with this new project, you should probably listen to the extended version, because Drake talks about the opportunities that are available. Now, from listening out for communications from other worlds to creating other worlds in the lab, physicists hoping to understand how the rules that govern the very small, quantum mechanics, can be made to fit with those that hold sway over the very large, general relativity, have been struggling to find systems to test the effects of both theories together. Now, Keith Schwab, a physicist at the California Institute of Technology, is aiming to give them some help by creating an artificial system with the equivalent of 100 million times Earth's gravitational field.
Heavy.
This system, built from an accelerating nanowire, mimics the surface of a neutron star and could help those hoping to understand more about quantum gravity, a Schwab told reporter Corinne Pickemer.
In the early part of the 20th century, brilliant minds like Heisenberg, Schrödinger, Bohr, Planck, and Einstein came up with the foundations of quantum mechanics. This theory, which is notoriously hard to comprehend, describes the motion of the subatomic world extremely well. Despite its success, it has been difficult to match it up with another heavyweight theory, general relativity. Our classical world looks nothing like the quantum world in which particles can behave like waves, be in multiple places at once, and even be linked with particles in a completely different part of the universe. What makes macroscopic objects behave differently from microscopic ones? It could be that gravity destroys quantum states and makes particles behave according to classical rules, as Keith Schwab thinks. If so, then to truly understand nature, we will have to unify quantum mechanics and Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity. This is the aim of the field of quantum gravity. But since quantum mechanics and general relativity usually operate on such vastly different scales, it's tough to devise a way to test both of their effects on a single system. Schwab, who is a professor of applied physics at Caltech, has worked on the conundrum for over 15 years. By harnessing the principle of equivalence, which is the idea that there is no difference between acceleration and gravitation, he and his colleagues have found an elegantly straightforward way to create the extraordinary circumstances needed to bring quantum mechanics and gravity face to face in the lab. I caught up with Schwab on Skype at an unearthly hour for him, he couldn't sleep, to discuss the exciting new avenues his most recent discovery might open up. But first he explained the research that has led up to it.
This proposal is together with a long-term collaborator, Miles Blanco at Dartmouth University. And what Miles and I have been looking at for nearly 15 years now is trying to understand, you know, what can be done with quantum physics at large length scales. In the past, the way that we've approached this is to look at the quantum behavior of small mechanical structures. When you think of the fundamental particles, like electrons and photons and these small particles, they have this weird duality of both being acting like a particle, like a fixed little point in space, and also they can act like waves. So they can go around obstacles and interfere with themselves and do all kinds of things that waves do. The thing that we were interested in 15 years ago was, is it possible that collections of these small particles, like a billion atoms all linked together to form a little piece of solid, could aspects of that object, could it have quantum properties? Meaning, could you see quantum physics at large length scales?
The collection of small particles or nanomechanical structures they created are large enough to be observed under an optical microscope. The striking thing was that the objects did seem to follow the rules of quantum mechanics.
The most surprising kind of behavior that we were after was looking, let's say, at a superposition state where a mechanical structure is both deflected to the left and deflected to the right at the same time. And in quantum physics, that is a reality that's possible. And you see that kind of realities in experiments with atomic-sized particles. We wanted to see whether that's possible with larger particles. The punchline of that whole line of thought is that, yes, indeed, you can do quantum physics with mechanical structures. You can see the fact that the motion of a mechanical device, you need the quantum mechanics to describe its motion properly.
The mechanical devices are constrained by an uncertainty principle, just like other quantum objects. They can never be at rest, and you can manipulate their quantum fluctuations. In fact, it seems that you can do more or less everything that you would expect to do at quantum mechanical scales with these relatively large objects. The circumstances needed to directly test quantum gravity are extreme and hard to achieve. It is thought to only apply when large amounts of gravity are very tightly packed together into very small spaces, circumstances we generally only find in deep space. But with the help of a $44,000 FQXI grant, Schwab and his colleagues may have found a way to create these extremely high G-forces in the lab. Schwab explains how.
The interesting thing that we noticed was that small mechanical objects, when you shake them, and they can shake at high frequencies, some of them can vibrate back and forth at a gigahertz, which is a billion times a second. If you make them small enough, like a micron scale, so they're vibrating at a billion times a second, and if their amplitude of motion is just a nanometer, which is a small amplitude of motion, it's like, you know, 10 atoms deflection, it turns out that the acceleration of these mechanical devices is incredible. And you can easily realize in experiments that we do in the laboratory and, you know, devices that we and others make, you can get accelerations that are 100 million times the acceleration of gravity. So the, you know, gravitational field on Earth has, you know, if you drop something, something accelerates, and you can realize accelerations in a mechanical structure that are 100 million times bigger.
Einstein's theory of general relativity states that there is equivalence between acceleration and gravitation, meaning that when you are looking at high accelerations, you're also studying the physics of very intense gravitational fields. So by shaking their mechanical devices so rapidly, Schwab and his team are effectively creating high acceleration and therefore extreme gravitational fields. By combining their ability to create larger nanomechanical structures that still adhere to quantum mechanical principles with the ability to create high accelerations of these structures, they have made a powerful tool to help shed light on the unification mystery. Schwab again.
The gravitational fields that we're talking about are the same as the intensity of the gravitational field on a neutron star. Imagine the mass of the sun compressed into 10 kilometers. So it's about 10 to the 8 Gs of what we have here on Earth. And so I can't go to a neutron star to do experiments, but I can do this nanomechanical structure in a laboratory and simulate the gravitational fields on a neutron star. If we have devices that are quantum mechanical, they're in quantum states, and we have these enormous accelerations, then we start to have laboratory experiments where we can study the connection between gravitation and quantum mechanics. That's the punchline.
This ability to probe the connection between quantum mechanics and gravity in the lab opens up numerous directions for research.
What we'd like to do is to just to do some basic quantum interference experiments first, which is, you know, essentially launch quantum waves, you know, of whatever type, and then let them go two different paths and see if they can interfere. And so that's a basic kind of interference experiment that is done with light or, you know, done with matter waves. And now we're just learning how to do that with large mechanical structures. We're starting to poke around and think about how we might perform quantum interference experiments that utilize the high accelerations. And so Miles Blanco and I are working on a paper that we're going through review right now, where we basically look at the quantum mechanical phase shifts one would get if you had a device that was accelerating this fast back and forth, and to actually try to measure these kinds of phase shifts.
At this point in our conversation, Skype froze and we had to revert to a phone line. Once reconnected, Schwab told me there was more.
Other experiments that we're working on in the lab that are related to this is we're also working with a superfluid device to try to see quantum physics of motion, like in the mechanical structures, but with like gram scale samples of superfluid that are vibrating back and forth. And so we're trying to keep pushing this boundary of quantum physics to bigger and bigger length scales. You find the domain where the physics seems to work, and then you just keep trying to expand this domain. Ideally, you try to expand it to domains where it looks pretty ridiculous. Like seeing quantum physics at a meter length scale is kind of a ridiculous idea. We're willing to accept that the tiny particles can act strange and do all their weird stuff. But, you know, in the end, the matter around us, and maybe even us, are just collections of these small particles. So there's no logical reason to think that the collection of small particles, which is a large object, wouldn't behave in strange ways as well.
The ability has the potential to shed light on one of the biggest questions that has puzzled even the cleverest physicists for decades.
If the world is relatively well-behaved and boring, meaning it is as we think it is, then we should be able to show that we can get quantum phase shifts from very intense gravitational fields, or in this case, very intense accelerations. And that's something that Miles has worked on directly, is calculating exactly how big these quantum phase shifts should be. But like I said, if the world is relatively well behaved, then this is what we expect to see. We actually expect to see quantum mechanics working properly in these intense gravitational fields. If the world is more interesting, then we don't know what we'd quite see. It's kind of the Donald Rumsfeld of the unknown unknowns. But, you know, we just have no physics experiments to date in this kind of environment. So it's an exploration of a new parameter space. That's the first thing that we would gain from this. But, you know, in the end, the really interesting aspect is finding out whether quantum mechanics works as we expect it should in these kinds of intense gravitational fields.
Because quantum gravity only reveals itself at extreme g-forces that even the most advanced particle accelerators can't achieve, the field has been a mainly theoretical pursuit. But by combining his earlier work, in which he showed that the motion of nanomechanical structures does follow quantum rules, with the realization that he can make these structures vibrate so fast that they reach extreme g-forces, Schwab is giving the physics community the tools to probe quantum gravity in the safe comfort of the lab, as opposed to the violent environment of the neutron star. Now Schwab is keen to spread the word as widely as possible, so that other physicists can start to find answers to their own quantum gravitational questions by using his setup in their own labs.
It's pretty routine, actually. Like, the devices are not particularly special, and those amplitudes are not particularly high. So it's mostly a realization that these parameters are there, and we need to knit together the community that thinks about quantum gravity and the community that thinks about quantum physics at big scale. And those two groups don't often talk to each other. So this is at the interface between those two. My excitement in all this is just, hey, we can access a parameter space that's totally beyond what people thought was possible. And, you know, so let's go play there and see what happens. Let's write some papers and tell people about the parameters. And hopefully there's some really smart, deep thinking theorists on the other side of the planet who see this and are just like, yes, this is what I've been waiting for.
That was Keith Schwab speaking with Corinne Pickamer there. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you can read more about Schwab's work in an article by Corinne, in which she also discusses whether gravity could cause the transition between the quantum and the classical realm. And that's something that other FQXI members are looking into too, and we'll be following up with more from them in the coming weeks. So keep an ear out for part two of Corinne's report, coming soon.
Quantum mechanics, general relativity, superfluids, nanomechanical devices. That was a fantastic discussion by Corinne and Keith, but it just goes to show how specialized and technical the language of physics has become. We do our best on the podcast to cut through the jargon, but there are others who go much further. Astrophysicists Roberto Trotta of Imperial College London has written a whole book called Edge of the Sky, in which he describes the universe using only the 1,000 most common words in the English language, which was published by Basic Books in 2014 to critical acclaim, or perhaps we should say to high serious approval.
Is that much simpler? I'm not sure, yeah. But okay.
Our reporter, Sophie Ebden, went to meet him to find out what all the fuss is about, in as simple terms as possible, of course.
So I'm here at Imperial College's Blackett Laboratory to meet Roberto Trotta. You're a senior lecturer in astrophysics and also an experienced science communicator and author, to talk about your new book, Edge of the Sky. So can you tell us a little bit about what the idea of it is?
The Edge of the Sky is a radical experiment in science communication, at least the way I see it. Mm-hmm. I try to convey everything we know, and especially what we don't know about the universe, using only the most common 1,000 words in English.
Mm-hmm. And that doesn't even include the word 1,000?
No, it doesn't include the word 1,000, it doesn't include the word universe. So the very first question is, how do you talk about the universe without ever using the word universe? I thought this was a very good way of forcing me to communicate my science in as simple as possible terms and getting rid of jargon and really leveling the playing field so that everybody can enjoy and get involved into what I think are fundamental questions of reality. Where does the universe come from? What is its fundamental nature? What are all the things that we still want to find out about what the universe is made of and where it is going in the future. So The Edge of the Sky tries to convey not just the answers to all of those questions, but also the sense of marvel and amazement at the fact that we can see all the things and can, to an extent, understand them.
And the result is quite poetic, actually, I think, because I was reading it. It did feel quite magical, the way you describe it, because you're using such simple words. The science terminology does end up getting quite poetic. So you call the universe the...
all there is.
And scientists.
Student people.
So you tell the story through the eyes of a female protagonist. So why did you choose her?
It was a very natural choice for me to choose a woman as my main character. The story of the book follows student woman as she goes out one night to seek the help of Big Sear, one of the largest telescopes on Earth, to unlock the mysteries of dark matter. And so when I sat down and started writing the story, that character just came to my mind fully formed. In retrospect, there are many reasons why I think I chose her, and perhaps the most obvious the one that's certainly very close to my heart is the fact that we don't have enough women in science, particularly in physics, especially at senior level. The numbers drop off very sharply, unfortunately. If that can inspire perhaps a few young women to go into science, or just break this stereotype that all scientists are men, bald, middle-aged, and white, if that can help bring in some diversity and enhancing the numbers of women in science, then I'd be happy.
In terms of the writing process, what was it like? Did you like write it with your 1,000-word lexicon in front of you, or how did it work?
I discovered very early on that the way this worked was by thinking in this new language. So it wouldn't work if I tried to write the story in normal English and then translate it. You have really to get into the mindset of the language, just like when you speak a foreign language, after a while you become fluent in it and you start thinking in that language. It was a very similar process. And so once I got to that stage, then it became much easier for me to write in this very reduced Spartan lexicon that I'd given myself. And so I didn't need to check so much anymore which words were allowed and which weren't. Yeah. Technically, the way I did it was to write a small computer code that would check my writing for me to make sure that I didn't, didn't make any mistakes.
And did you have a lot of editing to do, or was it?
Yes. I sometimes feel that the last 10% took 90% of the effort. Because the book reads as a very simple text, but it was anything but effortless to put together, and so it hides lots of work.
And what's the reaction been like?
It's been very enthusiastic and surprisingly positive, as I must say. This is a science book unlike any other science book in a sense, because it doesn't fall squarely into any box of science communication or popular science. But precisely because of that reason, it turned out to appeal to people who wouldn't necessarily read your astronomy, popular science book, or cosmology, for which there's a plethora of very good examples out there. But because it plays with language, people who are interested in language have picked up the book and read it for that reason. And in doing so, I'm sure some of the science, some of the ideas have rubbed off them, and they perhaps have gotten excited about the science that I was talking about. And so I was very pleased to see that the book has found its way to very unexpected corners of the universe, as it were.
What was the hardest thing to write about?
The early universe.
The early universe. With all the different drops. You call the particles drops, don't you?
And that's right.
Mirror drops and sister drops.
Very small drops, etc. And so I had lots of difficulty, first of all, coming up with a zoo of drops that I was happy with in describing the sound in an accurate fashion. But also, I didn't have words like energy or velocity or speed or particle. I didn't have. And so all the things are very, very important for the early universe. I didn't have any of them. So it was a real challenge to come up with a description that I was happy with.
I wanted to also ask you about the haikus.
Mm-hmm.
Did you write these when you wrote the rest of the text, or were they kind of an addition later? Or?
In my head, at least, they came about as a way of doubly condensing what I wanted, the story that I wanted to try to tell. In other words, there are 10 chapters in the book, and so if you take all the 10 haikus, that's 30 lines, and if you put them all together, you get what I believe is a very condensed, very concise picture of the entire universe in just 63 different words. Now, whether this works or not, that's a different matter, but it attempts to do just that, to give you a very condensed version of what each chapter is about.
So are you a bit of a fan of haikus?
Yes, a little bit. Yes, I'm very stimulated by the fact that they not only require, they demand your active participation. They're not enough. They're very impressionistic in a way. And so you have to fill in the gaps. And that is precisely this active participation on the part of the reader that I was seeking to engage. I'm trying to depict the universe in a way that is as accurate as possible, but equally leaves enough room or as much room as possible for the reader's imagination. And that's exactly the place where I want my readers to go, that makes sense for them.
Are you promoting the book this summer?
Yes.
What kind of things are you
doing
to promote it?
I'm doing a number of events. I just came back from the Talkie Festival in Dublin, a book festival, which was a very nice experience for me. And then I'm going to the Guadalajara Book Festival in Mexico in November, which should be nice. It's one of the largest festivals in Latin America, so promoting the book there.
Has it been translated then?
It's been translated in German. The German edition will come out in September, and there is a Korean edition that's coming, and we're working on other translations as well. And also the Italian translation, because having Italian origins, although I grew up in Switzerland, and Italian being my mother tongue, I would be very excited and to see an Italian version of the book. It would be a project that would be very close to my heart.
Thank you to Roberto Trotta for speaking with Sophie Hebden there. It sounds like if you're looking for a book to add to your holiday wish list, you could do well to consider Edge of the Sky. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you can also view a video about Trotter and his book, made by Lucina Melissio Friedman, called The All There Is, which won a prize in our video contest last year.
Now that's all we have time for today, so thank you to Andrew Ponson, Frank Drake, Keith Schwab, Karin Pikema, Roberto Trotta, and Sophie Hebden.
He's been Brendan Foster.
And she's been Zia Morali.
I'm off to hunt for alien life.
And I'm going to accelerate to the equivalent of 100 million times Earth's gravity. I hope I do not get motion sickness.